Part 3. Bringing It All Together. Chapter 15. The Power of Presence. In October 2005, I spent 2 weeks in the Amazon jungle. My father had to go to Brazil to research gold mining operations for his book, The Dream Merchant, and there was no way I was going to let my pop disappear into the jungle without me. My buddy Dan took the trip with us, because he'd always dreamed of the Amazon. We spent much of the trip 250 kilometers south of Manaus, in an area called Tupana, where the outer reaches of the Trans-Amazonian Highway, the only connection to civilization, dwindle from a pitted two-lane road into a dirt path, with the forest canopy closing in from all sides until the trees are overhead and engulf what remains of the clearing. Every 10 or 20 miles, tiny villages exist, virtually untouched by the modern world. In this remote part of Brazil, there's a deep respect for the thin line between life and death. There are no layers of protection such as the ones most of us are used to. No grocery stores, no hospitals, no ambulances or policemen to buffer a bad moment. There is the sense among Amazonians that the jungle sits poised to devour the unwary. No one walks into the forest alone. Most people carry weapons. The danger is too great. While we lived in the rainforest, a man named Manuel acted as our guide. Manuel is a native Amazonian, born in Tupana, about 50 years old, powerfully built with shining brown eyes and the jungle in his blood. He led us through the dense foliage, quietly pointing out medicinal trees, animal tracks, insects, monkey vines, the signs of the forest. From time to time he would stop, raise a hand. Minutes passed. We stood silent and listened, the air alive with the sounds of animals feeding or moving nearby. Manuel carried a shotgun. His friend Marcelo trailed us with another. Cats were always on the mind. Throughout the trip, Dan and I asked a lot of questions about the jaguar. Walking through the forest at night, we wanted to be prepared for an encounter. We were given spears, which made us feel better, but over and over Manuel shook his head and explained that if a jaguar really wants you, there will not be much fight. It's rare for someone to speak of seeing a jaguar in the forest. If you see one, it's probably too late. People traveling in groups will, for the most part, be left alone. From time to time, the last person in a procession will be picked off from behind, but cats generally avoid teams. They're stealth hunters. A lone traveler will be moving through the forest, and the cat will be crouched on a limb of an overhanging tree, blending into the forest canopy, listening, waiting. Then, the ambush emerges from nowhere, and the cat is on your neck. In Manuel's descriptions of the jaguar, there seemed to be an almost religious respect for its power, cunning, and intensity. But what if I have a machete? How could I not have a chance? One evening, lying in hammocks above the forest floor, engulfed by deep blackness and the wild symphony of night sounds, Manuel told us what happened to a friend of his a few years before. This man was named Jose. He was born in the Amazon. He knew the jungle's sounds, its smells, its signs. He knew how to heal every conceivable ailment with saps and boiled barks of trees, roots, leaves. He climbed vines like a monkey, hunted every evening with a blowgun, and darts laced with the venom of poisonous frogs. Jose could operate from sound and smell alone, freezing in the dark forest, listening, then shooting his dart into the dusky woods and hitting his mark for his family's dinner. He was one of the rare ones who ventured into the forest alone. On these evenings he wore a mask on his head, eyes pointing backwards so the cats would not ambush him from behind. His only weapon was his small blowgun and a machete he apparently wielded like a samurai. One night, Jose was moving through the forest, darkness closing in, on the way home with a small capybara strapped to his back. Suddenly his skin prickled. He stopped, listened, heard the deep rumble of a cat. He smelled the animal, knew it was near. He felt for his blowgun, but it had been a long night hunting, and there were no darts left. Jose was standing next to a giant sumau maera tree, which are often used by Amazonians for communicating over long distances in the jungle. Immediately, Jose took his machete and swung it back and forth in a blur, clanging against the tree's magnificent exposed root, and sending a pounding call for help through the darkness. These vibrations can be heard over a mile away. Hopefully his son would be listening. Then Jose stood in silence, waiting. He smelled the cat. It was close. A few moments later, a large black jaguar, Onça Negra, over 200 pounds, glided down from a tree 20 feet ahead of him and started moving in. Jose remembered the glowing yellow eyes, as though a demon were coming for him. He knew if he ran, the cat would be on him instantly. He tossed his night's catch forward onto the forest floor, then held his machete and stood his ground, moving his weapon rhythmically, preparing for the fight of his life. The cat walked straight toward him, and then changed course about 8 feet away. It started pacing back and forth, keeping distance, but never taking its eyes off Jose. It watched the machete, followed its movements. At first, the jaguar's pacing felt good. Jose thought that maybe it was indecisive, considering the dead rodent. The minutes passed. Jose's arms got tired from swaying. He watched the rippling muscles of the cat's legs, imagined them hurling the beast on top of him. There would be only one chance. When the cat came, he would need to dodge and strike in a blur. He would have to get to the neck, or take off a limb and somehow roll away from the razor claws. It would all happen in an instant. But the waiting was eating him up inside. His whole being was on edge, poised for battle, exploding while the cat paced, languid, easy, yellow eyes glowing, edging closer, now 7 feet away, now 6 feet. After 10 minutes, the tension was unbearable. Jose was drenched in sweat. His right arm shook from the weight of the machete. He switched hands, felt the weapon in his left, hoped the cat didn't notice the new awkwardness for a minute or so while he recovered. He felt dreamy, as if the cat were hypnotizing him. Fear overwhelmed him. This man of the jungle was falling apart. After 15 minutes, the cat started moving faster. It edged in, coiled, watched the machete move, then turned back to pacing. It looked for openings, felt the timing of the weapon. Jose was all strung out. His nerves were frayed. The yellow eyes were taking him over. His body shook. Jose started sobbing. He backed away from the cat, and this was a mistake. The jaguar moved in, straight in. It showed its teeth, crouched to leap. Jose had no fight left. He gave himself up. And there was a crack through the night. Then shouting. The cat turned. Another crack rang out, and then two young men ran through the bush screaming. Jose's son took aim with his gun, but the cat vanished into the darkness, leaving a father weeping on the jungle floor. 3 years later, Jose still hadn't recovered from this encounter. The villagers say he went mad. His spirit was broken. When I heard this story, suspended in the Amazonian night, I was struck by how much I related to both the predator and the prey. I used to create chaos on the chessboard, until my opponents crumbled from the pressure. I loved the unknown, the questions, and they wanted answers. When there were no answers, I was home, and they were terrified. The game was mine. Then my psychology got complicated, and the tables were turned. In my early encounters with world-class grandmasters, I was usually beaten, like Jose. The chess position might be objectively even, but as the tension on the board mounted, it felt as though a vice was slowly cinching down on my head, tighter, tighter, until I reached a bursting point and made some small concession, like Jose backing up, a tiny imprecision that changed the character of the game, anything to release the pressure on my brain. Then they were all over me. Grandmasters know how to make the subtlest cracks decisive. The only thing to do was become immune to the pain, embrace it, until I could work through hours of mind-numbing complexities as if I were taking a lovely walk in the park. The vice, after all, was only in my head. I spent years working on this issue, learning how to maintain the tension, becoming at peace with mounting pressure. Then, as a martial artist, I turned this training to my advantage, making my opponents explode from mental combustion because of my higher threshold for discomfort. In every discipline, the ability to be clear-headed, present, cool under fire is much of what separates the best from the mediocre. In competition, the dynamic is often painfully transparent. If one player is serenely present, while the other is being ripped apart by internal issues, the outcome is already clear. The prey is no longer objective, makes compounding mistakes, and the predator moves in for the kill. While more subtle, this issue is perhaps even more critical in solitary pursuits, such as writing, painting, scholarly thinking, or learning. In the absence of continual external reinforcement, we must be our own monitor, and quality of presence is often the best gauge. We cannot expect to touch excellence if going through the motions is the norm of our lives. On the other hand, if deep, fluid presence becomes second nature, then life, art, and learning take on a richness that will continually surprise and delight. Those who excel are those who maximize each moment's creative potential. For these masters of living, presence to the day-to-day learning process is akin to that purity of focus others dream of achieving in rare climactic moments when everything is on the line. The secret is that everything is always on the line. The more present we are at practice, the more present we will be in competition, in the boardroom, at the exam, the operating table, the big stage. If we have any hope of attaining excellence, let alone of showing what we've got under pressure, we have to be prepared by a lifestyle of reinforcement. Presence must be like breathing. Chapter 16. Searching for the Zone. How can I learn to enter the zone at will, make it a way of life? How can I maintain my focus under pressure, stay serene and principled under fire, overcome distraction? What do I do when my emotions get out of control? In part one, I told the story of my chess career predominantly within the framework of the learning process. Now I'd like to briefly re-examine the arc of those years from the perspective of the performance psychologist. Recall that as a young boy, sometimes I became so deeply immersed in a chess position that the world seemed to fall away. Nothing existed but me and my jungle. During these moments, my mother says I seemed to become an old man, as if I knew this game from another life, playing for hours with a focus so intense that she thought her hand would burn if she placed it between my eyes and the board. Other days I would be distracted, chew bubblegum, look around and smile at spectators in Washington Square Park. It was hit or miss, and my poor parents and coach had to sit and deal with whichever Josh showed up that day. In time, when I started playing tournaments, I had to be more consistent, and so I started spending more effort on concentration. I sat at the board when I wanted to walk around. When my mood was flippant, I sucked it up and worked harder. I was an intense competitor, and have never been one to give up on a goal. As a funny aside, my ever-precocious sister started amusing herself with this never-quit aspect of my personality when she was 3 years old by giving me coconuts to open up on Bahamian beaches. I'd spend hours smashing away in the sun, refusing to give up until she was drinking and munching away. In my scholastic chess life, I was almost always able to put more energy into the struggle than my opponents. If it was a battle of wills, I won. When I started competing in adult tournaments, my amped up energy and focus sometimes worked against me. If you recall the chapter The Soft Zone, I began having problems with music or other distractions that got stuck in my mind. Initially, I tried to push the world away from me, keep everything silent, but this just amplified the noise. A random song, whispering spectators, distant sirens, ticking chess clocks, would take over my brain until chess became almost impossible to play. Then I had the breakthrough to think to the beat of the song, embrace distraction, and find an inner focus that could exist no matter what the external environment. For years I trained myself to deal with bad conditions, use them to my advantage. It turns out that the next movement of my life would put this training to the test on a much larger scale. When I was 15 years old, Searching for Bobby Fischer was released, and my life went Hollywood. Suddenly I was in the media spotlight, and the struggles of the chess world were compounded by extra pressures on my shoulders. When I played tournaments, fans were all over me, cameras followed me around, other players seethed with jealousy. If I had been more mature, I might have been able to translate my youthful experiences with music to this larger form of distraction. But I was off balance, and once again resorted to using my will to block everything out. Instead of rolling with the new vibe of my life, I handled the pressures by putting huge amounts of energy into each chess game. I recall two moments in particular, when I became a man possessed. One game was a critical matchup in the U.S. Junior Championship against the gifted Romanian emigre, Grandmaster Gabriel Schwartzman. The other was in the U.S. Championship in 1994, when I squared off against my trainer at the time, Grandmaster Grigory Kaidanov. In both games, the stakes were high, both professionally and emotionally. I was all business, and my intensity was a little wild. Both four-hour struggles passed in a blink. Nothing else existed for me. At one point during our matchup, while I was staring lasers at the board, working my way through the position, Schwartzman walked over to my father, who was in the audience, and told him that he had never seen me like this. He said my concentration was so fierce, it was scary sitting across from me. Against Kaidanov, I felt like a tiger in a cage, seething with raw energy. I won both those games, and played some of my most inspired chess. But what is interesting is that afterward I was profoundly depleted, and in both cases my tournament immediately fell apart. I blew myself out, and had nothing left for the rest of the competitions. In short, I was a mess. I had learned as a boy how to deal with distraction in a given moment, but the larger distractions of my life were overwhelming me, In an isolated situation, I could overcome the issues. I've always been able to bring it for the big game, but the kind of reckless intensity this required sapped me. At a high level, the chess world has many big games, and in long, grueling tournaments they tend to follow one another, over and over, for days and weeks at a time. I knew how to block out my issues in a sprint, but in marathons I ran out of gas. Consistency became a critical problem. On days that I was inspired, I was unstoppable, but other days I would play bad chess. The time had come for me to learn the science of long-term, healthy, self-sustaining peak performance. In the fall of 1996, my father read about the sports psychologist Jim Lehrer, who ran a performance training center called LGE in Orlando, Florida. LGE, recently renamed the Human Performance Institute, was founded by Lehrer, the esteemed sports nutritionist Jack Groppel, and the no-nonsense physical trainer Pat Echeberry, as an environment in which the physical and mental sides of the pursuit of excellence converged. By the time I first went down to LGE in December of 96, it was already becoming a mecca for athletes who wanted to hone their performance skills, professionalize their nutritional patterns, work out sophisticated everyday training routines to optimize growth, and balance public and personal lives. World-class tennis players, golfers, NFL and NBA stars, Olympic athletes, top CEOs, FBI SWAT teams, basically any kind of elite performer could be found in a given day working out in the high-tech gym, meeting with sports psychologists, or chatting with one another about the similarities of their experiences. I'll never forget my first afternoon in the LGE weight room. I was working with a trainer, having tests done on me to determine my exact level of fitness. I was using muscles I never knew existed, pushing my physical limits far beyond what I would have known was safe or possible. And I loved it. This was my first exposure to physical training, at as high a level of professionalism and sophistication as I've been conditioning my mind for so many years. There I was, sprinting on a high-tech stationary bike, sweating up a storm, hooked up to all sorts of monitors, when a guy slapped me on my back. I turned around to see Jim Harbaugh, with a big smile on his face. At the time, Jim was the star quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts. Being a huge Jets fan, I had not always rooted for Jim, but I had watched him play for years and admired his fiery competitive spirit. He had an arm like a cannon, was famous for last-minute comebacks, and was simply a fabulous athlete. I was surprised when Jim told me that he was also an avid chess player and had followed my career for a long time. We fell into a conversation about the psychological parallels of top-notch chess competition and quarterbacking in the NFL. I was amazed by how many of the same issues we wrestled with. I think that this conversation in the LGE gym was my first real inkling of how universal the arts of learning and performance really are. The two intertwined issues I wanted to take on at LGE were consistency as a competitor and my complicated relationship to the baggage that had come with searching for Bobby Fischer. When I first went down to Orlando shortly after my 20th birthday, I was still a pretty intuitive performer, operating from a natural mix of intensity, digested experience, and drive. As I described above, when things got rocky, my habit was to hit the gas and blow my opponent and myself out of the water with wildly energetic focus. This was clearly less than an ideal approach for the long term. The main trainer that I worked with at LGE was a deeply insightful sports psychologist named Dave Striegel. Over the years, Dave and I developed a close relationship and frequently spoke on the phone between my trips to Orlando. Although many valuable insights emerged from our dialogues, perhaps the most explosive revelation emerged from an innocent question during our first meeting. I remember it clearly. After a few hours of conversation, in which I described my life, my career, my current issues, Dave sat back, scratched his head, and asked me whether or not I believed the quality of a Chessic thought process was higher if it was preceded by a period of relaxation. This simple question led to a revolution in my approach to peak performance. That evening, after a long day of eye-opening sessions with Dave, Jim Lehrer, and Jack Groppel, I sat down with my laptop and chess notebooks and spent a few hours looking over my previous year of competitions. During chess tournaments, players notate their games as they go along. The chessboard is seen as a grid, with vertical ranks running A to H from left to right, and the horizontal files running 1 to 8, up, from White's perspective. After each move, a chess player will write down, for example, Bg4 or Qh5, meaning bishop moves to g4 or queen moves to h5. Usually, notation is kept on a sheet with a carbon copy beneath, which allows public and private records of all games to be saved. For a number of years, when notating my games, I had also written down how long I thought on each move. This had the purpose of helping me manage my time usage, but after my first session with Dave, it also led to the discovery of a very interesting pattern. Looking back over my games, I saw that when I had been playing well, I had 2 to 10 minute crisp thinks. When I was off my game, I would sometimes fall into a deep calculation that lasted over 20 minutes, and this long think often led to an inaccuracy. What is more, if I had a number of long thinks in a row, the quality of my decisions tended to deteriorate. The next morning, Striegel and Lair told me about their concept of stress and recovery. The physiologists at LGE had discovered that in virtually every discipline, one of the most telling features of a dominant performer is the routine use of recovery periods. Players who are able to relax in brief moments of inactivity are almost always the ones who end up coming through when the game is on the line. This is why the eminent tennis players of their day, such as Ivan Lendl and Pete Sampras, had those strangely predictable routines of serenely picking their rackets between points, whether they won or lost the last exchange, while their rivals fumed at bad calls or pumped a fist in excitement. Consider Tiger Woods, strolling to his next shot with a relaxed focus in his eyes. Remember Michael Jordan sitting on the bench, a towel on his shoulders, letting it all go for a 2-minute break before coming back in the game? Jordan was completely serene on the bench, even though the Bulls desperately needed him on the court. He had the fastest recovery time of any athlete I've ever seen. Jim Harbaugh told me about the first time he noticed this pattern in himself. He's a passionate guy and liked to root on his defense when they were on the field. But after his first sessions at LGE, he noticed a clear improvement in his play if he sat on the bench, relaxed, and didn't even watch the other team's offensive series. The more he could let things go, the sharper he was in the next drive. The notion that I didn't have to hold myself in a state of feverish concentration every second of a chess game was a huge liberation. The most immediate change I made was my way of handling chess games when it was not my turn to move. Instead of feeling obligated to stay completely focused on the chess position while my opponent thought, I began to let my mind release some of the tension. I might think about the position in a more abstract way, or I might even walk away from the board and have a drink of water, or wash my face. When my opponent made his move, I would return to the board with renewed energy. Immediately I started noticing improvement in my play. In the coming months, as I became more attuned to the qualitative fluctuations of my thought processes, I found that if a think of mine went over 14 minutes, it would often become repetitive and imprecise. After noticing this pattern, I learned to monitor the efficiency of my thinking. If it started to falter, I would release everything for a moment, recover, and then come back with a fresh slate. Now when faced with difficult chess positions, I could think for 30 or 40 minutes at a very high level, because my concentration was fueled by little breathers. At LGE, they made a science of the gathering and release of intensity, and found that regardless of the discipline, the better we are at recovering, the greater potential we have to endure and perform under stress. That realization is a good starting point. But how do we learn to let go? It's much easier to tell someone to relax than to actually do it on the free throw line in overtime of the NBA playoffs, or in the moments before making a career-defining presentation. This is where the mind-body connection comes in. The physical conditioners at LGE taught me to do cardiovascular interval training on a stationary bike that had a heart monitor. I would ride a bike keeping my RPMs over 100 at a resistance level that made my heart rate go to 170 beats per minute after 10 minutes of exertion. Then, I would lower the resistance level of the bike and go easy for a minute. My heart rate would return to 144 or so. Then I would sprint again at a very high level of resistance, and my heart rate would reach 170 again after a minute. Next, I would go easy for another minute before sprinting again, and so on. My body and mind were undulating between hard work and release. The recovery time of my heart got progressively shorter as I continued to train this way. As I got into better condition, it took more work to raise my heart rate and less time to lower my heart rate during rest. Soon my rest intervals were only 45 seconds, and my sprint times longer. What is fascinating about this method of physical conditioning is that after just a few weeks, I noticed a tangible difference in my ability to relax and recover between arduous thought processes in a chess game. At LGE, they had discovered that there is a clear physiological connection when it comes to recovery. Cardiovascular interval training can have a profound effect on your ability to quickly release tension and recover from mental exhaustion. What is more, physical flushing and mental clarity are very much intertwined. There was more than one occasion that I got up from the board 4 or 5 hours into a hugely tense chess game walked outside the playing hall, and sprinted 50 yards or up 6 flights of stairs. Then I'd walk back, wash my face, and be completely renewed. To this day, virtually every element of my physical training revolves around one form or another of stress and recovery. For example, during weight workouts, the LGE guys taught me to precisely monitor how much time I leave between sets so that my muscles have ample time to recover but are still pushed to improve their recovery time. When I began this form of interval training, if I was doing 3 sets of 15 repetitions of a bench press, I would leave exactly 45 seconds between sets. If I was doing 3 sets of 12 repetitions with heavier weights, I would need 50 seconds between sets. If my sets were 10 reps, I would take 55 seconds. And if I was lifting heavy weights at 3 sets of 8 reps, I would take 1 minute between reps. This is a good baseline for an average athlete to work with. In time, with consistent work, rest periods can be incrementally shortened, even as muscles grow and are stressed to their larger, healthy limits. Over the years, I've gotten better and better at returning from mental and physical exhaustion. While in my chess career, the necessity of such intense body work may seem strange, in my martial arts life, it's clear as day. The fighter who can recover in the 30 seconds between rounds and in the irregular intervals between matches will have a huge advantage over the guy who is still huffing and puffing, mentally or physically, from the last battle. On a more dynamic level, in Tai Chi Chuan, real martial power springs from the explosion from emptiness to fullness, or from the soft into the hard. So there are countless moments when I will release all tension for a split second in the midst of a martial flurry. Ultimately, with incremental training very much like what I described in the chapter Making Smaller Circles, recovery time can become nearly instantaneous. And once the act of recovery is in our blood, we'll be able to access it under the most strained of circumstances, becoming masters of creating tiny havens for renewal, even where observers could not conceive of such a break. In your performance training, the first step to mastering the zone is to practice the ebb and flow of stress and recovery. This should involve interval training, as I described before, at whatever level of difficulty is appropriate for the age and physical conditioning of the individual. This training could, of course, take many forms. I've already mentioned biking and resistance work, but let's say you enjoy swimming laps in a pool. Instead of just swimming until you're exhausted and then quitting, push yourself to your healthy limit, then recover for a minute or two, and then push yourself again. Create a rhythm of intervals, like the one I described with my biking. With practice, increase the intensity and duration of your sprint time and gradually condense rest periods. You're on your way. This same pattern can be used with jogging, weightlifting, martial arts training, or playing any sport that involves cardiovascular work. If you're interested in really improving as a performer, I would suggest incorporating the rhythm of stress and recovery into all aspects of your life. Truth be told, this is what my entire approach to learning is based on. Breaking down the artificial barriers between our diverse life experiences so all moments become enriched by a sense of interconnectedness. So, if you're reading a book and lose focus, put the book down, take some deep breaths, and pick it up again with a fresh eye. If you're at work and find yourself running out of mental stamina, take a break, wash your face, and come back renewed. It would be an excellent idea to spend a few minutes a day doing some simple meditation practice in which your mind gathers and releases with the ebb and flow of your breath. This will help connect your physical interval training to the mental arenas. If you enjoy the experience, gradually build up your mental stamina and spend more time at it. When practiced properly, Tai Chi Chuan, yoga, or many forms of sitting meditation can be excellent vehicles for this work. As we get better and better at releasing tension and coming back with a full tank of gas in our everyday activities, both physical and mental, we will gain confidence in our abilities to move back and forth between concentration, adrenaline flow, physical exertion, any kind of stress, and relaxation. I can't tell you how liberating it is to know that relaxation is just a blink away from full awareness. Besides adding to your psychological and physical resilience, this opens up some wonderful and surprising new possibilities. For one thing, now that your conscious mind is free to take little breaks, you'll be delighted by the surges of creativity that will emerge out of your unconscious. You'll become more attuned to your intuition and will slowly become more and more true to yourself stylistically. The unconscious mind is a powerful tool, and learning how to relax under pressure is a key first step to tapping into its potential. Interval work is a critical building block to becoming a consistent long-term performer. If you spend a few months practicing stress and recovery in your everyday life, you'll lay the physiological foundation for becoming a resilient, dependable pressure player. The next step is to create your trigger for the zone. Chapter 17. Building Your Trigger. One of the biggest roadblocks to releasing the tension during breaks of intense competition or in any other kind of challenging environment is the fear of whether we'll be able to get it back. If getting focused is hit or miss, how can we give up our focus once we've finally got it? Conditioning to this insecurity begins young. As children, we might be told to concentrate by parents and teachers, and then be reprimanded if we look off into the stars. So the child learns to associate not focusing with being bad. The result is that we concentrate with everything we've got until we can't withstand the pressure and have a meltdown. While later on in my career, I sometimes blew myself out with intensity during a game, in my early scholastic chess tournaments, my dad and I were very good at preserving my energy. Most of my young rivals had coaches who treated tournaments like military camp. Teachers and parents would make kids analyze their games extensively between rounds, trying to wring a chess lesson out of every moment, while I would be outside having a catch with my dad, or taking a nap. Maybe it's no accident that I tended to surge at the end of tournaments. My pop is a clever guy. This tendency of competitors to exhaust themselves between rounds of tournaments is surprisingly widespread and very self-destructive. Whenever I visit scholastic chess events today, I see coaches trying to make themselves feel useful, or showing off for parents by teaching students long, technical lessons immediately following a 2-hour game, and an hour before the next round. Let the kid rest! Fueling up is much more important than last-minute cramming, and at a higher level, the ability to recover will be pivotal. In long chess tournaments that may last for over 2 weeks, one of the most decisive factors is a competitor's ability to sleep at night. Even the strongest grandmasters need their energy to come through in the home stretch. In the martial arts world, this theme is also critical. The ability to wait for hours on end without exploding with tension or losing your edge is often what separates the top fighters before they step in the ring. Big tournaments involve a lot of downtime between matches. Some fighters keep themselves in a state of feverish alertness, always poised for action for fear their moment might come and they won't be ready. The more seasoned competitors relax, listen to headphones, and nap. They don't burn through their tanks before stepping on the mats. This phenomenon is not unique to the fields I've chosen. We don't live within a Hollywood screenplay where the crescendo erupts just when we want it to, and more often than not, the climactic moments in our lives will follow many unclimactic, normal, humdrum hours, days, weeks, or years. So how do we step up when our moment suddenly arises? My answer is to redefine the question. Not only do we have to be good at waiting, we have to love it. Because waiting is not waiting, it's life. Too many of us live without fully engaging our minds, waiting for that moment when our real lives begin. Years pass in boredom, but that's okay because when our true love comes around or we discover our real calling, we'll begin. Of course, the sad truth is that if we're not present to the moment, our true love could come and go and we wouldn't even notice. And we will have become someone other than the you or I who would be able to embrace it. I believe in appreciation for simplicity, the everyday, the ability to dive deeply into the banal and discover life's hidden riches, is where success, let alone happiness, emerges. Along these lines, when considering the issue of performance state, it's important to avoid focusing on those rare climactic moments of high-stakes competitive mayhem. If you get into a frenzy anticipating the moment that will decide your destiny, then when it arrives, you'll be overwrought with excitement and tension. To have success in crunch time, you need to integrate certain healthy patterns into your day-to-day life so that they're completely natural to you when the pressure is on. The real power of incremental growth comes to bear when we are truly like water, steadily carving stone. We just keep on flowing when everything is on the line. In recent years, I've given many talks on performance psychology. At the beginning of an event in Los Angeles a few years ago, I was approached by a top Smith Barney producer, call him Dennis, who said he was having trouble accessing a good performance state and often found himself distracted in important meetings or under deadline. He asked my advice about how to figure out what his hot button was. Dennis knew that some professional athletes have routines that consistently put them into a good frame of mind before competition. He just couldn't find the right routine. No matter how hard he tried to discover the perfect song, meditative technique, stretching exercise, or eating pattern, he just couldn't make it work. Ideally, Dennis said he would like to have a song that slipped him into the zone. What should he do? This is a problem I have seen in many inconsistent performers. They are frustrated and confused, trying to find an inspiring catalyst for peak performance, as if the perfect motivational tool is hovering in the cosmos waiting for discovery. My method is to work backward and create the trigger. I asked Dennis when he felt closest to serene focus in his life. He thought for a moment and told me it was when he played catch with his 12-year-old son, Jack. He fell into a blissful state when tossing a baseball with his boy, and nothing else in the world seemed to exist. They played catch virtually every day, and Jack seemed to love it as much as his dad. Perfect. I've observed that virtually all people have one or two activities that move them in this manner, but they usually dismiss them as just taking a break. If only they knew how valuable their breaks could be. Let me emphasize that it doesn't matter what your serene activity is, whether you feel most relaxed and focused while taking a bath, jogging, swimming, listening to classical music, or singing in the shower, any such activity can take the place of Dennis's catch with his son. The next step was to create a 4 or 5 step routine. Dennis had already mentioned music, meditation, stretching, and eating. I suggested that an hour before the next time he played catch with his son, Dennis should eat a light snack. We decided on a blended fruit and soy shake that he enjoyed making in his kitchen. Then he would go into a quiet room and do a 15-minute breathing exercise that he had learned a few years before. It was a simple meditative technique where he followed his breath. When he noticed his mind wandering, he just released the thought like a cloud gliding by and returned to his breath. For beginners, this meditation may seem frustrating because they notice their minds racing all over the place and feel that they are doing badly, but that is not the case. The return to breath is the key to this form of meditation. There is no doing badly or well, just being with your breath, releasing your thoughts when you notice them, and coming back to breath. I highly recommend such techniques. Not only is the return to breath a glimmer of the zone, a moment of undistracted presence, but the ebb and flow of the experience is another form of stress and recovery training. Finally, if there is nothing in your life that feels serene, meditation is the perfect hobby to help you discover a launching point in your search for a personalized routine. Dennis has had a light snack and done some breathing exercises. After these 25 minutes, the next step would be a 10-minute stretching routine from his high school football days. I asked Dennis what kind of music he listened to. He had eclectic taste, everything from Metallica to Bob Dylan to classical. I told him that I loved Bob Dylan as well. We decided on Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, a beautiful, mellow, long Dylan song. But really any music would have worked, depending on the individual's preference. After listening to the song, Dennis would get his son, and they would go outside and toss around the baseball, as they did every day. I told Dennis to treat the catch like any other catch, just to have fun. So we created the following routine. 1. Eat a light, consistent snack for 10 minutes. 2. 15 minutes of meditation. 3. 10 minutes of stretching. 4. 10 minutes of listening to Bob Dylan. 5. Play ball. For about a month, Dennis went through this routine every day before playing catch with his son. Each step of the routine was natural for him, and playing ball was always a joy, so there was no strain to the experience. The next step in the process is the critical one. After he had fully internalized his routine, I suggested that he do it the morning before going to an important meeting. So Dennis transplanted his routine from a prelude to playing catch with his son to a prelude to work. He did so, and came back raving that he found himself in a totally serene state in what was normally a stressful environment. He had no trouble being fully present throughout the meeting. The point to this system of creating your own trigger is that a physiological connection is formed between the routine and the activity it precedes. Dennis was always present when playing ball with his son, so all he had to do was set up a routine that became linked to that state of mind. Clearly, it would have been impractical for Dennis to tow Jack around everywhere he went. Once the routine is internalized, it can be used before any activity, and a similar state of mind will emerge. Let me emphasize that your personal routine should be determined by your individual tastes. If Dennis had so chosen, he could have done cartwheels, somersaults, screamed into the wind, and then taken a swim before playing catch with his son. And over time, those activities would have become physiologically connected to the same state of mind. I tend to prefer a routine like Dennis's because it is relatively portable and seems more conducive to a mellow presence, but to each his own. I have used routines before competitions for the last 10 years of my life. At chess tournaments, I would meditate for an hour while listening to a tape that soothed me, and then I would go to war. When I started competing in the martial arts, I already knew how to get into a peak performance state under pressure, and had little trouble dealing with less competitively experienced opponents. Then, I ran into a new problem. In November of 2000, I traveled to Taiwan to compete in my first Pushhands World Championship. I had never been to an international martial arts tournament, and was awed by the chanting fans in the bleachers and the elaborate traditional opening ceremony, in which thousands of competitors marched with their country's flags waving above. More than 50 nations were represented, each with a unique training style. While I watched the other competitors warm up, I was impressed by their athleticism and obvious mastery. The alien feeling of the environment seemed to heighten the threat of my opponents. I was feeling off balance, so I went into my routine, which at that point was a 30-minute visualization exercise. I came out of it raring to go. It was 9 a.m. I was supposed to have one of the first matches, and I was ready to roll. Then the waiting began. The clock passed 10 o'clock, then 11 o'clock. I didn't speak the language, and no one would tell me when I was scheduled to compete. I had heard that my opponent was a Taiwanese star, but I had no idea what he looked like. I was hungry, but there was no food available at the arena, and my teammates and I had been under the impression that all first-round matches would be early in the morning, so we didn't bring snacks. Big mistake. I had been informed the contestants would be announced over the loudspeaker 5 minutes before their match began, and if they failed to show up immediately, they would lose by forfeit. So I had to spend hours, hungry, ready to go on immediately for fear of leaving to eat a snack and getting thrown out of the tournament. Finally, at noon, a break in the action was announced. Lunch boxes were served to all competitors. At 12:15, I was given a greasy platter of pork fried rice and duck. Far from ideal for the moment, but I was starving and had little choice. So I ate. At 12:30, it was announced that I should report immediately to the judge's table. I was informed my match was starting immediately. My opponent was already warmed up, in a sweat, and had clearly known the exact nature of the tournament's schedule. I was disconcerted, unprepared, and had a stomach full of greasy food. I got destroyed. It wasn't even close. It was a little bit of consolation to see my opponent dominate the tournament and go on to win 2 consecutive world championships, but I hated the fact that I had traveled all the way to Taiwan and had not even given myself a chance to compete. Some serious adjustments were called for. First of all, the nutritional side of this story is very important. I should not have trusted the posted schedule, and should have had something to sustain me throughout the wait, no matter how long it lasted. I had learned from Jack Groppel at LGE to eat 5 almonds every 45 minutes during a long chess game, to stay in a steady state of alertness and strength. In martial arts tournaments, I now tend to snack on Clif bars, bananas, and protein shakes whenever necessary. Or, if I know I have at least an hour, I might have a bite of chicken or turkey. Only you know your own body. But the key to nutrition in unpredictable environments like Taiwanese martial arts tournaments is to always be prepared for exertion by being nourished, but never to have too full a stomach and thereby dull your senses. The nutritional lesson is an easy one. I was careless and paid for it. But a much more serious question arose. What good is a 30 or 45-minute routine if you only have minutes or seconds of warning before the big event? In life, after all, things don't always go according to schedule. Ideally, we should be able to click into the zone at a moment's notice. This is where my system for condensing the routine comes in. Let's return to Dennis. Where we left off, his routine was as follows. 1. Eat a light, consistent snack for 10 minutes. 2. 15 minutes of meditation. 3. 10 minutes of stretching. 4. 10 minutes of listening to Bob Dylan. He had already learned to export this routine from playing catch with his son Jack, and could now go through the 4 steps before business meetings or any other stressful event and be in a great state of mind throughout. Dennis loved the results, and now he did his routine before every meeting. He had taken to scheduling important events right after lunch, so he had some time alone to prepare. He felt great, was more productive, and loved the fresh energy with which he was tackling anything he put his mind and routine to. That's already pretty good. The next step of the process is to gradually alter the routine so that it's similar enough so as to have the same physiological effect, but slightly different so as to make the trigger both lower maintenance and more flexible. The key is to make the changes incrementally, slowly, so there is more similarity than difference from the last version of the routine. This way the body and mind have the same physiological reaction even if the preparation is slightly shorter. Dennis started doing his routine every day before work, the only difference being that he would eat a larger breakfast than the light snack, and he would listen to Dylan during his short drive to the office. Steps 2 and 3 took place at home, after breakfast, as originally planned. Everything was going beautifully. Next, for a few days, Dennis meditated for 12 minutes instead of 15. He still came out in the same great state of mind. Then he stretched for 8 minutes instead of 10. Same presence. Then he changed the order of the stretch and meditation. No problem. Over time, slowly but surely, Dennis condensed his stretching and meditation routine down to just a few minutes. Then he would listen to Bob Dylan and be ready to roll. If he wasn't hungry, he could do without the snack altogether. His routine had been condensed to around 12 minutes and was more potent than ever. Dennis left it at that because he loved Dylan so much, but the next step would have been to gradually listen to less and less music until he only had to think about the tune to click into the zone. This process is systematic, straightforward, and rooted in the most stable of all principles, incremental growth. As for me, the Tai Chi meditative movements became my routine. Every day before training at my dojo, we took about 6 minutes and did the form. Then Pushen's class began, and a number of the top students went at it with the same intensity with which we would approach the competition. I learned virtually everything I know about Tai Chi from my years of training in that studio on 23rd Street. There was no place more peaceful and energizing for me. So in addition to the standalone benefits of Tai Chi meditation, my body and mind learned to connect the form with my peak performance state because I always did the form before training in my most inspiring setting. But I did not leave it at that. I had learned that martial arts tournaments are, if anything, unpredictable. We don't always have 5 minutes of peace and quiet before going to battle. After my disconcerting experience in the 2000 World Championships, I spent a number of months shortening the amount of preparation I needed to be primed for the moment. The essence of the Tai Chi meditative movements is the continued gathering and release of body and mind as the practitioner flows through the various martial postures. As I inhale, my mind comes alive, and I visualize energizing from my feet into my fingers. When I exhale, the mind relaxes, the body de-energizes, lets go, winds up, and prepares for the next inflation. In essence, if you ignore the concrete strengths of the various postures, Tai Chi meditation is the practice of ebb and flow, soft and hard, yin and yang, change. So in theory, I should be able to condense the practice to its essence. Incrementally, I started shortening the amount of form I did before starting my training. I did a little less than the whole form, then 3/4 of it, half, 1/4. Over the course of many months, utilizing the incremental approach of small changes, I trained myself to be completely prepared after a deep inhalation and release. I also learned to do the form in my mind without moving at all. The visualization proved almost as powerful as the real thing. This idea is not without precedent. Recall the numbers to leave numbers, form to leave form, and making smaller circles discussion in part 2. At a high level, principles can be internalized to the point that they are barely recognizable even to the most skilled observers. I now handle the unpredictability of martial arts tournaments with ease. In fact, the more adverse the environment, the better off I feel, because I know my opponents will not deal with the chaos as well as I will. When I arrive in the tournament hall, I get a rough sense for when things will begin. Then I do the Tai Chi form a couple times, so my body is loose and flowing. I relax, eat a little at a time so I'm ready on a moment's notice. If they call my name and say I must report immediately, I go through as much or as little of a routine as I have time for, and I'm good to go. No problem. The ideal for any performer is flexibility. If you have optimal conditions, then it's always great to take your time and go through an extended routine. If things are less organized, then be prepared with a flexible state of mind and a condensed routine. Of course, the advantages to such condensing practice extend far beyond the professional or competitive arenas. If you are driving your car, crossing the street, or doing any other mundane activity, and are suddenly confronted by a potentially dangerous situation, if you are trained to perform optimally on a moment's notice, then you may emerge unscathed from some hair-raising situations. But far more critical than these rare climactic explosions, I believe that this type of condensing practice can do wonders to raise our quality of life. Once a simple inhalation can trigger a state of tremendous alertness, our moment-to-moment awareness becomes blissful, like that of someone half-blind who puts on glasses for the first time. We see more as we walk down the street. The everyday becomes exquisitely beautiful. The notion of boredom becomes alien and absurd as we naturally soak in the lovely subtleties of the banal. All experiences become richly intertwined by our new vision, and then new connections begin to emerge. Rainwater streaming on a city pavement will teach a pianist how to flow. A leaf gliding easily with the wind will teach a controller how to let go. A house cat will teach me how to move. All moments become each moment. This book is about learning and performance, but it is also about my life. Presence has taught me how to live. Chapter 18. Making Sandals. To walk a thorny road, we may cover its every inch with leather, or we can make sandals. Anger, fear, desperation, excitement, happiness, despair, hope. Emotions are part of our lives. We would be fools to deny such a rich element of the human experience. But when our emotions overwhelm us, we can get sloppy. If fear reduces us to tears, we might not act effectively in a genuinely dangerous situation. If we seethe when someone crosses us, we may make decisions we come to regret. If we get giddy when things are looking up, we'll probably make some careless mistakes that turn our good situation upside down. Competitors have different ways of approaching their emotions in the heat of battle. Many either feel that their natural movements are irrepressible or fail to consider the question altogether. These are not ideal approaches. If we don't think the issue through, chances are we'll be controlled by our passions. There are performers who recognize the disruptive potential of emotions and try to turn them off, become cold, detached, steely. For some personalities, this might work, although in my opinion, denial tends to melt down when the pressure becomes fierce. Then there are those elite performers who use emotion, observing their moment and then channeling everything into a deeper focus that generates a uniquely flavored creativity. This is an interesting, resilient approach based on flexibility and subtle introspective awareness. Instead of being bullied by or denying their unconscious, these players let their internal movements flavor their fires. Over the years, at various stages of my development, I've found myself all over the spectrum. In time, I've come to believe that this last style, rooted in my notions of the soft zone and the internal solution, is a potent launching point for a unique approach to performance. In this chapter, I'll focus on one of the most decisive emotions, one that can make or break a competitor: anger. As we enter into this discussion, please keep in mind the three steps I described as being critical to resilient, self-sufficient performance. First, we learn to flow with distraction, like that blade of grass bending to the wind. Then we learn to use distraction, inspiring ourselves with what initially would have thrown us off our games. Finally, we learn to recreate the inspiring settings internally. We learn to make sandals. My own experience with anger in competition began with being jerked around by a rival of mine, whom I mentioned in part one of the book. This kid was a hugely talented Russian player who immigrated to the U.S. when we were 15 years old. Immediately, he and I were the top two young players in the country. Boris knew how to push my buttons. He was unrestrained by any notion of competitive etiquette or even by the rules. He would do everything it took to win and would sometimes do things so far outside the lines of normal chess behavior that I was totally taken aback. Consider the hilarity of this moment. We were in the U.S. Junior Championship, last round, playing for the title. I'm 4 or 5 minutes into a deep thought process. This is the critical position. The ideas are coming together. I'm approaching a solution. And suddenly, Boris kicks me under the table, 2 or 3 times, hard. Boris studied karate, and I know he liked to kick things, but this was ridiculous. There were many times that Boris pummeled me under the table during critical moments of our games. But of course, not all of his tactics were so over the top. He would shake the board, loudly clear his throat in my face 5 or 6 times a minute, tap pieces on the table while I tried to think, or confer about the position in Russian with his coach. The standard reaction to such moments is to go tell the arbiter what's happening. The problem is that when this happened, Boris would feign innocence, insist in Russian and broken English that he had no idea what I was talking about, and the arbiter would have nothing to go with. Even if Boris was reprimanded, he had succeeded in getting my mind off the position. He was winning the psychological battle. I found Boris's disregard for sportsmanship infuriating. People like him hurt the game that I loved. I mentioned in part one that we had both traveled to a world championship in India to represent the United States, and several teams lodged formal protests against the American team because he and his coach were blatantly cheating throughout the event. The whole situation made me sick. The problem is that it also made me angry. Time and again in critical moments of our games, Boris would pull out some dirty trick, and I would get irritated and make an error. To his credit, Boris knew how to get in my head. As a teenager, anger clouded my vision, and Boris played me like a drum. After losing a couple games to him, I realized that righteous indignation would get me nowhere. I decided to block my anger out. When Boris tapped pieces, I took a deep breath. When he talked about the position with his coach, I just played knowing I'd have to beat both of them. When Boris shook the board, I ignored him. This might have seemed a good strategy, but the problem with this approach is that Boris didn't have a limit. He was perfectly content to escalate the situation, for example by leg-kick combinations, and eventually I'd get pissed off and have a meltdown. It took me some time to realize that blocking out my natural emotions was not the solution. I had to learn to use my moment organically. Instead of being thrown off by or denying my irritation, I had to somehow channel it into a profound state of concentration. It wasn't until my martial arts career that I really learned how to do this. It took work. The first time this issue came up in my competitive martial arts life was in the finals of my first Tai Chi Chuan Pushhands National Championship in November 2000. I had cruised through the tournament thus far, and was in the lead in this match until my opponent headbutted me in the nose, which is blatantly illegal. The referee didn't see it, and play continued. The rules of this particular tournament were that points were scored when someone was unbalanced and either thrown into the air, on the ground, or out of a large ring. No blows to the neck, head, or groin were allowed. About 15 seconds later, he headbutted me again, harder, and a wild surge of anger flew up through my body and into my eyes. The blood rush to the eyes that comes with a hard blow to the nose is, I believe, where the expression seeing red comes from. I saw red, and went out of control for about 10 seconds. On the video, it looks like my methodical style somehow mutated into bullish madness. I was over-aggressive, off-balance, and completely vulnerable. Quite literally, I was blinded by rage. I almost lost the nationals in those moments, but fortunately I returned to my senses and was able to win the match. A weakness of mine was exposed, and luckily I didn't have to lose to learn. This experience was disturbing to me on a number of levels. There's the competitive angle, but for me there was also a much more important idea at stake. My relationship to the martial arts is rooted in nonviolence. I don't get into fights. I don't want to hurt anyone. I believe that our world is destroying itself with a cycle of violence begetting violence, and I don't want to have any part in that cycle. I first got involved with Tai Chi Chuan as a movement away from ego, away from fighting. I was drawn to the experience of harmony and interconnectedness that felt like a counterpoint to the dog-eat-dog chess world. As I got deeper into the martial side of Tai Chi, and later the grappling art Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, this inner harmony would be tested continuously. To some, this might seem like a contradiction. Why step into a martial arts ring if you don't want to fight? My personal relationship to this question involves continuous internal cultivation. It's easy to speak of nonviolence when I'm in a flower garden. The real internal challenge is to maintain that fundamental perspective when confronted by hostility, aggression, and pain. The next step in my growth process would be to stay true to myself under increasingly difficult conditions. For the year following this incident at the Nationals, I devoted myself to staying principled when sparring with creeps. I sought out dirty players and got better and better at keeping cool when they got out of control. There were a couple of guys in particular who were very useful to me in this training. I'm sure you remember Evan, the big fellow from the Investment and Loss chapter, who used to throw me against the wall. He wasn't a bad guy, but he always pushed me to my limit with his aggression. Much of our training took place during this period of time. There was another fellow I'll call Frank, who was much more of the genuine article. He'd been a big push-hands competitor for a number of years, and he didn't like to lose. When he was having trouble, he got dirty. He made his own rules. His particular method of choice was to attack the neck. In push-hands, the target area is shoulders to waist. Barehanded attacks to the neck can be quite dangerous, and it's normal training etiquette not to target the neck at all. But whenever Frank felt threatened or unstable, he would start jabbing fingers at the Adam's apple. I had one or two ugly experiences with Frank doing this when I was a beginner, well before the Nationals headbutt scene. I didn't like his vibe, felt he was out of control, and for the most part avoided training with him. Now that changed. I had an issue to work on, and Frank would be the ideal training partner. The first step I had to make was to recognize that the problem was mine, not Frank's. There will always be creeps in the world, and I had to learn how to deal with them with a cool head. Getting pissed off would get me nowhere in life. Once I started training with Frank again, I quickly realized that the reason I got angry when he went after my neck was that I was scared. I didn't know how to handle it, and thought I would get hurt. He was playing outside of the rules, so a natural defense mechanism of mine was anger and righteous indignation, just like with Boris. So, first things first, I had to learn to deal with neck attacks. There was a period of months that I asked a few trustworthy training partners of mine to target my neck in push-hands class. I got used to neutralizing these attacks. Then, whenever Frank came into school, I sought him out, and we worked together. Whenever he felt me controlling him, he predictably started going after my neck. When this didn't work, he'd expand his target area, sometimes aiming at an eye, knee, or the groin. My goal was to stay cool under increasingly bad conditions. After a year of this training, I went back to San Diego to defend my title at the Nationals. Predictably enough, in the finals I faced off with the same guys the year before. The opening phase of the match was similar to our previous meeting. I began by controlling him, neutralizing his aggression, building up a lead. Then he got emotional and started throwing headbutts. My reaction was very different this time. Instead of getting mad, I just rolled with his attacks and threw him out of the ring. His tactics didn't touch me emotionally, and when unclouded, I was simply at a much higher level than him. It was amazing how easy it all felt when I didn't take the bait. There were two components to this work. One related to my approach to learning, the other to performance. On the learning side, I had to get comfortable dealing with guys playing outside the rules and targeting my neck, eyes, groin, etc. This involved some technical growth, and in order to make those steps, I had to recognize the relationship between anger, ego, and fear. I had to develop the habit of taking on my technical weaknesses whenever someone pushed my limits, instead of falling back into a self-protective, indignant pose. Once that adjustment was made, I was free to learn. If someone got into my head, they were doing me a favor, exposing a weakness. They were giving me a valuable opportunity to expand my threshold for turbulence. Dirty players were my best teachers. On the performance side, I had made some strides, but still had a long way to go. First of all, I had to keep my head on straight no matter what. But this was only the initial step of the process. The fact of the matter is that we have our natural responses to situations for a reason. Feelings of anger and fear and elation emerge from deep inside of us, and I think blocking them out is an artificial habit. In my experience, competitors who make this mistake tend to crumble when pushed far enough. I recall reading a New York Times article about the New York Jets place kicker Doug Bryan days before the Jets took on the Pittsburgh Steelers in the 2004 NFL playoffs. Bryan talked confidently about going into a meditative place before every kick. He said that he isolated himself from his surroundings, and he claimed that even under huge pressures, his mind was completely empty before each kick. When I read this, I felt suspicious about his process that completely bothered me, and I called my dad and told him I was worried about our kicker. Sure enough, when the Jets took on the Steelers, everything came down to two critical kicks. The first one, Bryan kicked short. The second, he shanked way left. In an interview right after the game, he said that after the first miss, all he could think about was getting it long enough. One miss, combined with big pressure, to jolt Bryan out of his perfect calm. He fixated on his last mistake and was anything but empty-minded. The fact of the matter is that while I love meditation and believe wholeheartedly in training oneself to operate calmly under pressure, there is a difference between the practice field and a hostile, freezing-cold stadium filled with screaming fans who want you to fail in the biggest moment of your life. The only way to succeed is to acknowledge reality and funnel it. Take the nerves and use them. We must be prepared for imperfection. If we rely on having no nerves, on not being thrown off by a big miss, or on the exact replication of a certain mindset, then when the pressure is high enough, or when the pain is too piercing to ignore, our ideal state will shatter. The soft zone approach is much more organic and useful than denial. The next steps of my growth would be to do with anger what I had with distraction years before. Instead of denying my emotional reality under fire, I had to learn how to sit with it, use it, channel it into a heightened state of intensity. Like the earthquake and the broken hand, I had to turn my emotions to my advantage. It's been my observation that the greatest performers convert their passions into fuel with tremendous consistency. There are examples in every discipline. For basketball fans, think about the Reggie Miller Spike Lee saga. Lee is New York's number one Knicks fan. Reggie Miller was the star of the Indiana Pacers from 1987 to 2005. Throughout the 1990s, the Knicks and Pacers repeatedly met in the playoffs, and Lee would be sitting in his courtside seat in Madison Square Garden for every home game. Time and again, he would heckle Miller until Miller started to respond. At first, this looked like a good situation to Knicks fans. Spike was distracting Reggie from the game. Sometimes it seemed that Reggie was paying more attention to Spike than to the Knicks. But then, it became apparent that Miller was using Lee as fuel for his fire. Over and over, Reggie would banter with Spike while torching the Knicks with unbelievable shooting. After a while, Knicks fans just hoped Spike would shut up. The lesson had been learned. Don't piss off Reggie. Incidentally, young NBA players learned the same lesson during the Michael Jordan era. Jordan was a notorious trash talker on the court. He would goad defenders into dialogue. But the problem was that if you talked back, it inspired Jordan to blow you off the court. The only thing to do was to let Jordan talk and play your game. Try to keep some of the beast asleep. Then he would just score his 30 points and move on to the next game. But if you woke the beast, Mike would score 50 and then do it again next time you played him. A few years ago, I was talking with Keith Hernandez about the role of anger in his career. For those who are not big sports fans, Keith was a dominant force with the St. Louis Cardinals and then the New York Mets, playing Major League Baseball from 1974 to 1990. Keith won 11 Gold Glove Awards, won the batting title and National League Most Valuable Player Award in 1979, and led the Mets to victory in the historic 1986 World Series against the Boston Red Sox. Hernandez is known as one of the toughest hitters in baseball history. I asked Keith how he dealt with pitchers throwing at him. A pitcher will sometimes either hit a batter or come very close to hitting a batter with a pitch in order to plant a psychological seed. Getting nailed by a 90-mile-an-hour fastball is not a pleasant experience, and many serious injuries have come out of this dark gamesmanship. The infamous scenes of hitters charging the mound and clubhouses emptying into terrible brawls are usually the result of a batter feeling that he's being targeted. If the batter is actually hit, he automatically gets on first base, as if he were walked. This is obviously less than great for a pitcher, but it's a calculated decision, because many batters will get psyched out by being pelted, and they will be scared at the plate for the rest of the game, or even for years when facing that pitcher. Knowing that the fastball might be tailing toward your head complicates the hitting experience, and many batters get intimidated, or they get mad. Either way, if a pitcher feels that he can get in your head by throwing at you, in Keith's words, you'll be on your butt. For Keith, pitchers dug their own graves by targeting him. He explains, "That was always a positive motivational thing for me. If a pitcher knocked me down or hit me on purpose, well, by golly, you've got your hands full for the rest of the year with me, particularly the rest of this game." Over the years, pitchers learned to stay away from Keith, because they'd be rousing a giant by hitting him. Keith told me a story about Frank Robinson, one of the all-time greatest baseball players, and the only man to be MVP of both the American League and the National League. Robinson began his career in Cincinnati back in 1956. In those days, pitchers threw at batters all the time. The Reds were playing a 3-game series against St. Louis, and in the first game, Robinson got hit by a pitch and went on to have a phenomenal night. The next day, the pitcher hit Robinson again, and he just destroyed the Cardinals throughout the whole series. A week later, the two teams played another series. But before it began, Red Schoendienst, the St. Louis manager, and Keith's first manager, called a team meeting and said, "The first pitcher who hits Frank Robinson is fined $100. Just leave him alone." Keith loves this story. It represents what a truly dominant competitor should be all about. Guys like Miller, Jordan, Hernandez, and Robinson are so far beyond shakable that opponents, instead of playing mental games, cower for fear of inspiring them. Returning to my own experience, I've steadily worked on integrating my natural emotions into creative states of inspiration. Of course, there were stages to this process. As a teenager, I was thrown off by emotion and tried to block it out. Then, in my early 20s, during my initial experiments with Buddhist and Taoist meditation, I worked on letting my emotions pass like a cloud. This was interesting, as it opened up a working relationship with my emotional reality, very much like how I described working with the unconscious in the chapter Slowing Down Time. Instead of being dominated by or denying my passions, I learned how to observe them and feel how they infused my moment with creativity, freshness, or darkness. Once I had a working relationship with my emotions, I began to take on my psychological reaction to foul play in the martial arts with a bit more subtlety. I believe that at the highest levels, performers and artists must be true to themselves. There can be no denial, no repression of true personality, or else the creation will be false. The performer will be alienated from his or her intuitive voice. I'm a passionate guy. The fact of the matter is that I don't really like dirty players. Their relationships to competition, to ego, to sport, to art, to violence, to foul play, it all rubs me the wrong way. The next step in my training would be to channel my gut reaction into intensity. This is not so hard once you get comfortable in that heated up place. It's more about sweeping away the cobwebs than about learning anything new. We are built to be sharpest when in danger, but protected lives have distanced us from our natural abilities to channel our energies. Instead of running from our emotions or being swept away by their initial gusts, we should learn to sit with them, become at peace with their unique flavors, and ultimately discover deep pools of inspiration. I have found that this is a natural process. Once we build our tolerance for turbulence and are no longer upended by the swells of our emotional life, we can ride them and even pick up speed with their slopes. For a period following that second national championship, I worked on myself. First, I learned to stay cool when training with dirty players, and then I started to use my passion to my advantage, to use my natural heat. When working with guys who got out of control, I would feel an organic change in my body chemistry. While initially this may have been disorienting, Now I used it to sharpen my game, up the intensity, funnel my primal heat into a penetrating focus. I was no longer being governed by self-protectiveness and fear, and so there was no disorienting anger. In time, I discovered that instead of being thrown off by the likes of Frank, I played my best against them. My next competitive experience with a dirty player was in the 2002 Pushhands World Championships in Taiwan. Early in my first round of the tournament, the Austrian representative, a noticeably unpleasant man, delivered an entirely illegal and quite painful uppercut to my groin. He was a highly skilled martial artist, and I was in a lot of pain. But it was astonishing how his antics backfired. I smiled at him, and he cursed at me. I felt no anger, just resolve. As the match continued, he kept on trying to get in my head in every way imaginable. He went for my groin, tried to take out my knee, continued to attack well after the referee had called stoppages. I didn't react, except to buckle down. Every dirty move may be just a little steelier, and what was interesting was that the less his rage affected me, the more flustered he got. He became increasingly aggressive. His failure to get in my head consumed him, made him crazy, and as he got more and more heated, he lost track of the technical side of the game, and I picked apart his overextensions. This guy was used to rattling opponents with foul play, and by being unmoved, I turned his tactics against him. He landed one cheap shot, but I knocked him out of the tournament. Of course, there's an array of emotions beyond anger that can emerge in pressured scenarios. Truly superb competitive psychologists are finely attuned to their diverse moods and to the creative potential born of them. The former world chess champion Tigran Petrosian was known by his rivals to have a peculiar way of handling this issue. When he was playing long matches that lasted over the course of weeks or even months, he would begin each day by waking up and sitting quietly in his room for a period of introspection. His goal was to observe his mood, down to the finest nuance. Was he feeling nostalgic, energetic, cautious, dreary, impassioned, inspired, confident, insecure? His next step was to build his game plan around his mood. If he was feeling cautious, quiet, not overwhelmingly confident, he tended to choose an opening that took fewer risks and led to a position that harmonized with his disposition. If feeling energized, aggressive, exceedingly confident, he would pick an opening that allowed him to express himself in a more creative vein. There were countless subtle variations of mood and of opening. Instead of imposing an artificial structure on his match strategy, Petrosian tried to be as true to himself as possible on a moment-to-moment basis. He believed that if his mood and the chess position were in sync, he would be most inclined to play with the greatest inspiration. Garry Kasparov, world chess champion for nearly 20 years and perhaps the strongest chess player of all time, had a different approach to his emotions. Kasparov was a fiercely aggressive chess player who thrived on energy and confidence. My father wrote a book called Mortal Games about Garry, and during the years surrounding the 1990 Kasparov-Karpov match, we both spent quite a lot of time with him. At one point, after Kasparov lost a big game and was feeling dark and fragile, my father asked Garry how he would handle his lack of confidence in the next game. Garry responded that he would try to play the chess moves that he would have played if he were feeling confident. He would pretend to feel confident and hopefully trigger the state. Kasparov was an intimidator over the board. Everyone in the chess world was afraid of Garry, and he fed on that reality. If Garry bristled at the chessboard, opponents would wither. So if Garry was feeling bad, but puffed up his chest, made aggressive moves, and appeared to be the manifestation of confidence itself, then opponents would become unsettled. Step by step, Garry would feed off his own chess moves, off the created position, and off his opponent's building fear, until soon enough the confidence would become real, and Garry would be in flow. If you think back to the chapter Building Your Trigger, and apply it to this description, you'll see that Garry was not pretending. He was not being artificial. Garry was triggering his own by playing Kasparov chess. As you can see, there are many different approaches to handling your emotions under fire. Some are better than others, and at the high end, perhaps your personality should determine the nuance of your fine-tuning decisions. That said, I highly recommend that you incorporate the principles of building your trigger into your process. Once you're no longer swept away by your emotions and can sit with them, even when under pressure, you will probably notice that certain states of mind inspire you more than others. For some it may be happiness, for others it may be fear. To each his own. Petrosian was very flexible. Miller, Hernandez, and Robinson worked well with anger. Kasparov and Jordan were intimidators. They inspired themselves by wilting opponents. Once you understand where you lie on this spectrum, the next step is to become self-sufficient, by creating your own inspiring conditions. Kasparov triggered his zone by acting confident, and then creating the conditions on the chessboard and a dynamic with his opponent in which he played his best. Miller talked with Spike Lee until he got fired up. When Spike wasn't around, Reggie still liked to play the bad guy. In fact, he was at his very best in the playoffs, on the road, competing in a stadium filled with hostile fans. If the fans weren't hostile, he might goad them into hating him. Reggie thrived as the villain, and triggered these conditions whenever he needed a boost. But how do you play your best when there's no one around to provide motivation? There is no cookie-cutter mold to inspiration. There is, however, a process we can follow to discover our unique path. First, we cultivate the soft zone. We sit with our emotions, observe them, work with them, learn how to let them float away if they're rocking our boat, and how to use them when they're fueling our creativity. Then we turn our weaknesses into strengths until there's no denial of our natural eruptions, and nerves sharpen our game, fear alerts us, anger funnels into focus. Next, we discover what emotional states trigger our greatest performances. This is truly a personal question. Some of us will be most creative when ebullient, others when morose. To each his own. Introspect. Then make sandals. Become your own earthquake, Spike Lee, or tailing fastball. Discover what states work best for you, and like Kasparov, build condensed triggers so you can pull from your deepest reservoirs of creative inspiration at will.